Welcome back to Word Balloon, the comic book conversation show. This is John Suntress. Today, a conversation with legendary writer Jerry Conway. Jerry made his mark at DC and Marvel early in his career, working on both companies' biggest icons, significant runs on Superman and Spider-Man in particular, including their first team-up in that deluxe Treasury edition of the 1970s with artist Ross Andrew. We'll be talking about his pair-ups with Ross and other classic Marvel artists, including John Romita, Gil Kane, and talk about some of the big moments in the Marvel and DC universe that Jerry was responsible for, like the birth of the Punisher and the death of Gwen Stacy. Jerry spent a good portion of the 90s and early 2000s writing for the TV series Law & Order, but he's back to comics, working for DC, looking at Buddy Baker, Animal Man, 25 years down the line in his career, and suddenly finding his powers are fading. It's the last days of Animal Man, a six-issue miniseries from DC Comics, with art from Chris Bautista. This episode of Word Balloon is brought to you by the Comic Book Podcast Companion from Tomorrows, a great book that was just written by Eric Houston. Here's the description of the book at the Tomorrows website. Comic book podcasts have taken the internet by storm, and now Tomorrows is offering you the chance to go behind the scenes of 10 of today's top comic book podcasts with new interviews from the cast of Around Comics, Quiet Panelologists at Work, Comic Book Queers, iFanboy, The Crank Cast featuring Mike Norton and Chris Crank, The Collected Comics Library and Tune In Podcast hosted by Chris Marshall, Augie DeBleek's Pipeline Podcast, Comic Geek Speak, and me, Word Balloon. Good chapter, actually, on Word Balloon. He also has interviews with comic creators Matt Fraction, Tim Seeley, and Gene Colan. You'll also find a guide of what you need to start your own podcast, an index of more than 30 great comic book podcasts, numerous photos of your favorite podcasters, I would look away from those photos, and original art from Gene Colan, Tim Seeley, and Mike Norton, with a spectacular new cover by Mike Manley. The book retails for $15.95 at the Tomorrows website. You can pick it up for $13.56 if you go to tomorrows.com. And a digital version of the book is also available separately for $9.95. It's the Comic Book Podcast Companion from Tomorrows. The conversation with Jerry begins with a look at his return to the comic book scene. I have to ask, and I know you've covered this in some written interviews that you've done, what brought you back to comics? Because as you say, you've had a wonderfully successful career in television and film, and particularly in television, Law and Order. You're one of their go-to guys and were for so many years. Why back to comics?
Well, for a variety of reasons. I think primarily the difference between working in film and television and working in comics, at least at the level that I can work, is in film and television, you're constrained by the financial imperatives of the medium. This is a very high-risk medium where, for an average episode, for example, of a show like Law & Order, you're talking about a budget of $2.5 million
wow.
for an episode. That's a big risk.
Yeah.
So the amount of supervision, interference, oversight that you're going to experience, even if you're, a respected writer, is going to be tremendous. By contrast, the financial investment in a issue of a comic book is relatively minor. So if you're someone who is, I think well thought of or, has a track record, you're more likely to be allowed a certain amount of independence in your writing than you would be in film or television. So as someone who's worked in the television and film world for about 20 years and, accomplished, a fair amount, I also banged my head against that wall, that creative wall, more than a few times, and found it to be kind of frustrating, and certainly in comparison to the amount of freedom that I would have writing comics. So about a couple of years ago, I pretty much hung up my shingle, where I actually took my shingle down, let's put it that way, as a television writer, and turned away from that particular part of my career, and have been sort of casting around trying to decide what it was that I'd like to do for an encore, and returning to comics where I have a certain amount of history and a fan base and an interest that I have just for it as a medium. seemed like a kind of a natural move.
I know a lot of current writers that will cite, there are the obvious stories like the death of Gwen Stacy that, you know, they'll cite as classic, and I know there's a great contingent of current writers like Brad Meltzer and Jeff Johns who are a big fan of JLA Detroit, one of your babies. Yeah. And
yeah,
so
I'm always amazed by that. Given the amount of, you know, what's funny is that the things that you get criticized for or that you get a lot of flack for at the time often end up being what you're best remembered for fondly, you know, by people years later, which is really amazing to me. You know?
Sure.
And kind of counterintuitive, you know. It's like you'd expect that the work that gets you praise and respect at the time, you know, would be what you would be remembered and respected for later, but often that's not the case.
Well, let's talk about this current story, The Last Days of Animal Man.
Yeah.
I go back to some printed interviews that I've read of yours, and I think it's interesting and wonder if, as you return to comic books, as a writer, do these initial stories come to you in the form of a premise versus a specific character? Tell me, because I think I had read that maybe you started with a different hero in mind for this story and then, you know, found a good fit as well with Buddy Baker, Animal Man.
Well, actually, what happened in this case was that I came up with the premise, the notion, you know, I was playing around in my mind, what stories do I want to tell?
Mm-hmm.
When I was, you know, a young man, when I was in my late teens and early 20s and writing books like Spider-Man, I was writing about myself. You know, I mean, I was writing Peter Parker at the same age. I was the same age that he was as a character, so I could relate to his experiences. But today, I wouldn't necessarily think that I'd be able to immediately relate to Peter Parker's issues. But I could relate to the idea of someone, you know, looking at his life from the viewpoint of a major change in his ability to accomplish the things that he used to be able to accomplish. In other words, you know, like a midlife crisis, which is a natural part of growing older. And I thought, you know, what's the metaphor for that in terms of a superhero? Well, in terms of a superhero, it's a character who is going through the crisis of losing his powers. And not losing them because, you know, he's been exposed to red kryptonite or because he's been attacked by a villain, you know, who's, you know, got some machinations against him. But, you know, just as a natural part of life, this happens. And what would you do, you know, if you're this character? Well, I didn't have a specific character in mind, primarily because the way that the comic book business is run these days, all of these characters have ongoing, you know, and rather complicated storylines that are interwoven with each other. So for me to come in and say, hey, how about we do a story where Aquaman, you know, suddenly can't breathe underwater anymore, you know, is not a practical suggestion.
Okay.
So I came to Joey Cavalieri, who had been asking me if I had any notions for a story, and I said, you know, this is the basic idea. Do you have a character that you think this would fit? Does DC have someone that they think would, you know, be a suitable protagonist for this? And they came back with the idea of, let's do it with Animal Man. Let's set it, you know, in the future so that we don't have to worry about continuity. And it really worked. You know, I thought, you know, this is a guy who's an everyman type of character. You know, father, husband, you know, an ordinary guy in his real world life. It would make a really good fit for this particular premise.
He is definitely one of those everyman heroes, and I know that a lot of the successful writers with him have portrayed him as such. As someone who came back to comics, and I know that you did a lot of research on Buddy, what did you think of some of the runs like Grant Morrison's run and some of the stories that have been told already about Animal Man?
No, I think you've got... To my mind, there's two separate existences for Animal Man. There's the existence in which he is part of the regular DC universe, and then there's the existence in which he was a character in a Grant Morrison series at Vertigo.
Mm-hmm.
And there's some overlap in that these are both the same guy, but the Grant Morrison stories are not so much about Buddy Baker as they are about comic books. you know, they're a deconstruction of comic book storytelling, not really driven by an internal set of issues that Buddy Baker is going through. They're more driven by interests that Grant Morrison as a writer is bringing to it. So, to me, Grant's stories, while I have to reference the internal material that occurs in those stories, are not really relevant to the story that I'm telling, because he was telling a different kind of comic book story.
Okay.
He was telling a story about comic book stories.
Sure. No, you're absolutely right.
Right. You know, it's just not, that's not what I'm doing. I'm telling a story about Buddy Baker, a guy in, you know, in his late 40s, early 50s, who's experiencing a natural change as a human being.
I think it's interesting that you've hit the ground running creating a couple villains right away. We've only seen one right now as we're recording this. Issue one's the only one that's been out. I understand there's a second one coming. But as you say, it seems middle age is really the villain in this story.
Well, you know, I found this to be true when I came back to writing Spider-Man in the late 80s. I don't know whether this frustrated my editor or not, but I had, at that point, for whatever reason, I had lost, not interest, but, you know, I'd lost a certain amount of passion for the superhero part of the story. And I was more interested in what was going on for Peter Parker and Mary Jane and the cast of characters that surrounded him in his personal life as opposed to his superhero life. So I did a extended storyline that featured those characters, and almost, I won't say as an afterthought, but, you know, it sort of flipped around the format that Stan had created, which was to do a superhero story with overtones of personal life stories filtered through it. And what I did was a story about Peter Parker with overtones of superhero stories filtered through that. And in the same sort of way, you can't do, I mean, to be interesting to a reader of comics, you know, since it's a graphic and visual media with a lot of possibilities for the action and the large scale visuals, you can't just do an internal story by focusing on the internal conflict. You need to somehow express it through a physical and dynamic conflict.
Mm-hmm.
And the characters that I created for him to battle, I won't say they're metaphors, but they certainly reflect aspects of the issue.
For sure.
Him. You know, you have Blood Rage, who is physicality personified, you know, and is, you know, everything that Buddy isn't at this moment, you know, a powerful physical entity that's driven purely by you know, his need for additional power. And the second character they were bringing in, which starts in the second issue, is this daughter of the illegitimate daughter of the second Mirror Master, and she's sort of a emblematic of another aspect of what Buddy's going through, which is, you know, the how his powers affect the people around him. You know, how his being a superhero has had an effect on the people around him, because she's an example of someone who was destroyed. I mean, her life was destroyed by her father being a supervillain. You know, so she has a, you know, very real, not a metaphoric sense, but, you know, again, you know, sort of emblematic of the other issue that's going on for him. I don't try to bang anybody over the head with this. Mostly what I do is I have Buddy being banged over the head by the villains. but it enables me to sort of do an externalization, you know, of the internal drama.
Well, and his kids are so young in the current DC universe, and they haven't come into the story yet, but will we see them in this?
Oh, yeah.
Okay,
oh,
so...
Yeah.
So clearly we're going to deal with, yeah, I guess...
we're going to see Maxine as a young adult and Cliff as a young adult. And we're going to see how they've been affected by having a father who you know, lived the life that Buddy lived. I mean, it's not a story in which there are any, in which the main characters come off particularly well or particularly badly. I mean, they come off like people, I hope, you know, with strengths and flaws. And Buddy, as both a hero and as a human being, has his strengths and his flaws, and how they affect the people in his life, you know, is part of what that story is, and how Maxine and Cliff, growing up in that, have become the people that they've become is also part of that.
That's great. You know, I'm only about 10 or 12 years younger than you. I'm 44 and grew up reading the different stages of comic book writing in what was once, I think, you know, books that were written for a 12-year-old audience. And feel free to correct me if I'm wrong. But
no, really, absolutely right.
You also were very active through the late 80s and early 90s, where we had the initial deconstructive period. And now I think today's more successful writers are able to tell these very personal human stories with, just as you say, using the action as not only a metaphor, but, you know, you've got to have something exciting to read, you know, to look at while they're dealing with the internal conflict. But there have been a few writers that have been kind of knocked for what is called decompressed storytelling. And I wonder if you saw that same characteristic when you read a lot of today's books by the current younger writers.
Well, I think like in any large group of people, there's a variety, you know, of approaches and talents.
Mm-hmm.
The best of the writers today, I think, you know, do try to combine these things, and to do it seamlessly and to do it without, you know, being obvious about it. You know, we don't want, in a way, as being like magicians, we don't want you to know how we're doing the trick, right?
So, okay, fair enough.
A good writer doesn't want it to be so obvious, you know, that this is what they're doing. I think people like Jeff Johns, you know, Brad Metzer, you know, Jeff Loeb, you know, are all people who, you know, get it, you know, and bring that kind of balance, you know, to their storytelling. You know, in terms of people who are mostly interested in just doing the conversation or just doing the talk, you know, the talking heads, I can empathize. You know, I mean, I feel like that's something I was sort of into in the late 80s, you know, where, as I said, you know, I sort of flipped it around and was doing stories about Peter Parker in which the Spider-Man stories were, you know, the secondary element.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard. I mean, you know, it's hard, I think, for some writers, to get past the boredom, get
sure.
with the standard material, you know, and you either come back to it, and that, I'm very grateful that I've had this opportunity to come back to it, because I feel like I'm past the boredom, you know. I mean, I was bored with this material at one point, just because I had done so much of it, and you know, I knew how it worked. Now I come back to it, and I'm like, oh well, this is kind of fun. You know, this is a fun way to break up a story, to make things happen, you know, and to keep me interested. But I can sympathize, you know, and empathize with writers who, you know, just get tired of writing an action scene, you know, and they're more interested in what's going on in that conversation. You know, and they forget that you can do both. You know, you can have a conversation in the middle of an action scene. You know,
sure.
And it can be fun. So it's just, and this is fine. You know, I mean, the field is big enough now that you can do all these different kinds of things.
Tell me about working with your artist today, as opposed to back in the, you know, 70s and 80s. And I know I was reading in particular a concentration of your JLA work. And I was going to ask you, too, what it was like to work with a guy like Dick Dillon, and was surprised to read that you really didn't have any personal contact with him. It was really through the editor, you submitting
yeah.
a script. And also the interesting thing that you said, after a time you were able to figure out what his strengths were and the ability to write to those strengths. Is it more of a direct collaboration today for you?
Not on this particular job. Actually, I've never met Chris.
Okay.
And I've been writing my scripts in advance, you know. I mean, I've done it in what we used to call DC style, but both companies now do it both ways. You know, they do Marvel style and DC style, where they either break the story down and provide dialogue after the art, or write a full script in advance.
Mm-hmm.
And in this particular one, I've been writing a script in advance. I just finished issue 4.
Okay.
And all I've really seen is issue 1. You know, I haven't seen the pencils on any of the other issues. And actually, I take it back. I saw half of the pencils on issue 2. But I haven't really seen in depth, you know, the work. And I'm having fun with that. You know, I mean, I like being surprised by what Chris is doing. I'm trying to be very consistent in my writing so that I don't pull the rug out from under him by throwing something in later, you know, and doing one of these, oh, by the way, I forgot to mention that, that in this particular location, there's this device, you know, that I didn't happen to mention 5 pages ago.
Okay.
So I'm trying to play fair with him and alert him to where I'm going as I'm writing the script. And that's something that I've learned from writing television and working with directors in television, you know, learning what they need to do their job so that they can visualize the drama that, you know, I've put on the page.
You did, obviously, at the start, say the differences between writing comics and writing for television. Is a full script, because a lot of people that listen to the show are curious about the craft of writing as well. So I'm curious, are your full scripts different from what they were 15 years ago or 20 years ago?
They are. I like to think that they're more thought out. I wrote by the seat of my pants back in the period that, you know, I was most prolific in comics. I was writing, 5 to 6 titles a month. You know,
wow.
Full stories, and between 120 and 150 pages of comic books a month, which is an enormous amount of material.
Absolutely.
And out of that, I think I'd like to think that I wrote maybe, you know, two thirds of it was relatively good stuff. You know, I mean, at least at the level that I wanted to be writing at. But the problem with it is that when you're writing that quickly, it's very hard to be reflective about what you're doing. You know, you're sort of writing instinctively and from the gut, which is good, because when you're writing from the gut, you're writing what really matters to you, and you're tapping into, you know, your unconscious in a very productive way. But it's not being filtered. It's not being filtered by reflection or by the kind of insights that your conscious mind will bring to it, you know. Or you'll say, oh, maybe, you know, I can foreshadow this a little bit better. You know, if I can't foreshadow something if I don't know that I'm going to do it. This time around, writing Last Days, I know exactly where I'm going to end in this miniseries. I know what's happening in each issue before I come to it. I know what the structure of the story is going to be. And that enables me to set things up in ways that I didn't do before. So I'm happier with the results. I don't know whether it's a better result. You know, I mean, that's a question, you know, that really you can't answer. But I know that it's a more crafted result. So in that sense, I think it's a more mature writing style.
Is it hard to transition from the 3-act television play to the 5-issue or 6-issue current comic book miniseries and story
not
beats?
Really, because both are based on classical structure. This is going to sound very pretentious, but you know, there's really only one or two ways to structure a story. 3 acts is basically it. Actually, I will take it and extend it out to the 5-act structure that you have in Greek plays and in Shakespearean plays. And that, even in a three-act structure, you're still doing the classical five-act structure. You're just breaking it at different points.
Okay.
So a comic book story, a six-part comic book story, actually works very well for the classical structure, you know, even though the classical structure is five parts. You can make it work fairly easily. Every story has a beginning, middle, and an end, you know. Every story, you know, has an introduction, you know, a crisis, a development of the crisis, a climax, a denouement, and an aftermath. You know,
sure,
that's basically
sure.
it. And, you know, that's what you're doing with a comic book story. I actually knew that when I was writing before, so it, in a structural sense, my work hasn't changed that much.
Who were your early comic book influences that kind of helped shape your writing style?
In terms of story, I'd say Gardner Fox was a fairly influential writer. Gardner Fox and John Broome.
That's great.
You know, under Julie Schwartz, because they also worked in that kind of classical structure. You know, they were what I took for them was their structure, not necessarily their language. In terms of the heart of the stories, I'd say it was Stan Lee, because Stan was the one who brought in the idea that stories should be about people, you know, and what people are experiencing and what is happening to them on the inside, you know, is reflected in what they're doing on the outside. And in terms of language, I'd say Roy Thomas was a very strong influence. And Denny O'Neill, too, you know, but less so. I mean, Denny, while I'm an admirer of Denny's work, I don't think I was ever influenced by it very much.
Okay.
You know, I think that he and I sort of went on parallel tracks. I mean, he was influenced by some of the same things I was influenced by. So I consider, you know, he and I sort of the same generation of writers, and Roy and Stan and Gardner of the previous generation.
I found it interesting looking at some of the early stuff that you had a hand on creating, and in particular three horror titles, where it seemed you did the first book, and then the books were handed on to different people. And I'm thinking of Werewolf by Night, Man-Thing, and Tomb of Dracula.
Yeah, no, actually, in all three of those cases, it was a collaboration with Roy, too.
Okay.
Roy came up with the initial premises of all those books, and in some cases, I think he actually wrote a plot for the stories. And then I took them and developed it, you know, internally and from a character point of view. So, yeah, I mean, I think Werewolf by Night I was most connected with, you know, of the three books. I wrote Werewolf, I think, for, I want to say, like 10 or 11 issues, but I'm not sure. I was sort of the go-to guy, you know, the Johnny of all trades for Marvel and for DC over the years, because I'm a fairly facile, and this is also true in television, it was true for me. I'm facile at adapting my style to other people's styles. And that's not necessarily a talent that I think highly of, but it is one that I have.
Okay.
So I was able to come in and do, you know, stories, you know, in the voice of other writers, or follow up for Roy, for example, on something that he wanted to initiate. I could take it and take it the next step, but usually there was always something else that they needed me to do, so I would move on to the next thing.
Well, you put such a stamp yourself on Spider-Man, and eventually I'm going to have to be the, you know, 100 millionth person probably to ask you about the death of Gwen Stacy. But before I do that, I'm very curious about the Punisher. And in particular, and again, this is probably something that you've been asked maybe 50,000 times as opposed to the death of Gwen Stacy. But the character that, was it Mac Bolan? The executioner?
Yeah,
and was that a character that was, you know, being thought of in the creation for the Punisher?
Well, there were several characters. I mean, I was actually talking with someone else about this today. The Punisher was a reflection of the time that he was created in. We had this kind of vigilante, iconic mentality going on. You know, we had Death Wish and Dirty Harry and you know, the Executioner, you know, as you say, were all very popular characters. So it was, he was a character that I didn't expect or intend to be a mainline villain. I considered him, you know, when I first developed him for the story, he was supposed to be a secondary character to the Jackal, a one-shot knockoff character. And I thought, well, it'd be fun to do a, you know, a take on this kind of vigilante character. But in the writing of it and in the art by Ross Andrew, you know, it became so interesting. You know,
absolutely.
I was like, I could see that this guy had some potential beyond that, and the fan response was immediate. You know, we immediately got people wanting to see more of him. So one thing led to another, and there he went.
Well, and you and Ross Andrew were such an amazing team, and I should probably throw in Mike Esposito. I'm assuming he was the anchor on that stuff. Am I wrong, or?
He was the anchor on some of it, but we had John Romita inked some of it, and Frank Giacoya, you know, was an anchor. I'm not sure that Mike did ink that much of the Spider-Man stuff, because I'd have to go back and look. You know,
okay.
I don't honestly remember.
Well, specifically you and Ross, then. I mean, you know, that the wonderful Spider-Man Superman Treasury Edition book. I mean, that was, you know, just such a fun story. Were you able to work closer with Ross? I mean, when it was working Marvel style?
We worked very closely together.
Okay.
Ross and I, we had a very very similar approach to story, you know, and I found that I could have a conversation with Ross about where we would take the first third of a story and say, you know, in like 20 or 30 minutes we would break that down, and he would go off and do the pencils, and then I would be able to write the material, and it was like we were thinking the same way.
Wow.
So it was a very pleasant experience. You know, there were some writers some artists that I've worked with where, you know, it was a battle, you know, where we never saw things quite the same, and I was always disappointed, and they were always frustrated, and that kind of thing. But with Ross, it was always smooth. It was smooth sailing. He was, I think, one of the more underrated artists in comics, somebody who should really be rediscovered. You know, they talk about Marvel does these Marvel visionary books, and I really think they should be doing, you know, Ross Andrew Marvel visionary book.
I was pleased to...
really did, to my mind, the definitive 1970s Spider-Man. You know, was as important to Spider-Man's development as John Romita was in the 60s and Steve Ditko in the early 60s. But that's my opinion.
Well, I know a lot of fans that would agree, and I was happy to see that they are starting to collect your guys' run. I was talking to Mike Norton, one of the DC artists, and he's a huge fan of Ross Andrews, and when you guys were working together on Spider-Man, and he was even telling me, I told him I was going to talk to you, and he was like, yeah, I don't know why Marvel chose to do this at this time, but I'm glad they did. So maybe we'll see some more interest, and I hope more of your guys' work together does get collected, because it's certainly the Spider-Man of my childhood, and it was exciting stuff, and it, you know. Man, you really benefited from some amazing artists on Spider-Man, and I'm gonna of course ask you that obligatory Gwen Stacy moment, because man, I gotta tell you, it is still such an incredible scene and sequence of panels, and just that tragic, you know, classic Spider-Man moment of, you know, the success and failure of attempting to save her. Would you mind telling me? I mean. Going back to the idea of, you know, can we kill Gwen Stacy? I mean, getting permission from Stan and taking us through that whole process?
Sure. Actually, at that point, I had been on the book for maybe a year. I'm not sure how long I'd been on. Issue 21, I came on around 113. So, yeah, maybe about less than a year. And I had been working with John Romita for most of that, and Romita was the dominant half of the partnership, you know, as he should be, because he was a guy who had been around the character for many, many years and was, you know, really the go-to guy as far as the storytelling on Spider-Man. So a lot of the stories that he and I did together were stories where I would come up with the premise and then John would basically develop the story and the plot based on that overall premise. He was playing around with the idea. He wanted to do a story where we would kill off a main character because he felt that it had gotten to the point where things were, you know, settled and safe and simple. And he, as a fan, I think he was telling you this recently, as a fan of Milt Caniff, the cartoonist who did Terry and the Pirates and Steve Canyon, he was saying that Caniff was a big proponent of the idea of shaking things up by killing off a main character now and then. And so John had pitched this to Stan and to me, and Stan said, sure. You know, and Stan at that point really wasn't paying attention to the material. He was building his empire, you know, as the publisher at Marvel, expanding the books, you know, working on trying to get us into different markets and so on. So he didn't really, you know, he trusted that we all knew what we were doing, you know. So he had this kind of a hands-off attitude.
Okay.
And then as we were talking about it, you know, we came to the conclusion, I don't know whether it was, Romita was pushing for the idea of killing off Aunt May, and I didn't think that was a good idea. Because in my mind, Aunt May was a stabilizing force in Peter's life, you know, a touchstone. That if you removed it, would leave this gaping hole. How do you fill that relationship? You know, there's nobody else who can be that person to him. But in terms of his girlfriends, you know, I mean, in terms of the women that were in his life, he had gone through, you know, several by that point. You know, he'd had Liz Allen and Betty Brant. You know, and you know, there was always a sense that none of these women were permanent, with the exception of Mary Jane. To my mind, when I was a reader, you know, and I was reading the comics at the point when Mary Jane was first introduced, she brought something to the mix that I had not ever seen before. A very capable, very individual female character who did not need the hero. She didn't need him.
I hear you.
She didn't care that he was there. You know, I mean, she liked him. You know, she was potentially available, but she wasn't on the make for Peter Parker.
I hear you.
Gwen Stacy, on the other hand, was more of a traditional superhero. Love interest.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she was not an independent person in and of herself. She existed primarily, you got the feeling that if Peter went out of the rooms, she disappeared. You know, there was no there with Gwen Stacy. there you go. But so I never cared. You know, I never thought there was anything about her that made her compelling. She didn't bring anything to the dance, as far as I'm concerned. So I said, you know, well, what about Gwen Stacy? Let's just get rid of her. You know, that way we can clear the way for the really interesting character, Mary Jane. And, you know, there was sort of like, well, yeah, okay, that makes sense. You know, nobody thought anything one way or the other about it as being a good idea or bad idea. You know, they had basically cleaned house with her dad, you know, was gone, you know, so she and Harry Osborn had a relationship, but Harry Osborn had gone nuts, you know,
right.
with becoming the Green Goblin. So it really wasn't, you know, she didn't really serve any function other than as the girlfriend. So, you know, from a purely cold-hearted point of view, you know, let's dump her and bring on the other girl. And that was it. You know, we didn't think anything further of it. Now, in the telling of the story, it became much bigger. I think that because we felt like, okay, here we are, we're going to be killing off this character, let's make it count. And that, in the telling of it, it became much larger. It wasn't going to be just a building falls on her. It wasn't going to be, oh, she does something heroic and saves the day. It was going to be the fulfillment of who she was. And if you come down to it, who she was, in my mind, her role was to be captured and held hostage. I mean, that's basically what she brought to the story.
The damsel in distress.
Yeah, she was the damsel in the distress, tied to the railroad track. And my feeling was, well, what would be really interesting is if, the train actually ran over her.
Wow. Yeah.
What? We're always saying, oh, get to her before the train, and so on. Or what if, you pull her away from the train and she gets run over by a truck, when you pull her away from the train. That was my perversity, which was the idea that the hero, and certainly the idea that Peter Parker is a hero, was that he was a defective hero.
Absolutely.
He was a guy who, on his best days, when he succeeded, there was failure within it. And to me, this was just an extension of that. Okay, he will rescue her, but in the rescuing, it will result in her death. And I liked, I was perverse enough to think that was, kind of cool. And I didn't think that it would have the kind of reaction that the fan press had to it, which was as if I had, I'd gone out and killed Dorothy's Toto. I'd strangled Toto, and it was like, oh my God! And even at the time, I thought, who are they talking about? This girl was nobody. I realized today there was a great quote from Macbeth that relates to this. Which is referring to a character that was killed in the story. Nothing became as so much as nothing became his life so much as the leaving of it. What makes Gwen Stacy an iconic character is the fact that she died.
Absolutely.
Period.
Yeah.
That's all she's got. Somebody said to me, "Why is it that this is of all the characters in comics who've been killed off, is she the only one who's never come back?" I said, "Because she's only interesting because she's dead."
Here, here. And, well, whose idea was it to put the breaking of the neck? Because that was
I take full responsibility for that.
Well, and I'm not asking, if you don't want to say, that's okay, because much like Don McLean in American Pie, I'll let you, keep whatever references are still mysterious to you, and you release them when you want to, or I guess like the identity of Deep Throat. But, I mean, do you have a firm idea of the circumstance? Because what, as readers, we don't know is what killed Gwen Stacy.
Right.
Was it the fall?
Right.
Was it the grabbing of the web and the snapping of the neck? When did she die?
Well, here's the thing. As far as the characters inside the Marvel Universe are concerned, she died from the fall. The Green Goblin says that, to Peter. And Peter, I think, probably would have killed himself if he believed that he was responsible for what happened to her. So I think inside the Marvel Universe, while people might blame Spider-Man for her death, they don't actually consider him culpable of her death. He's blamed in the same way that George Bush is blamed for things that he's done.
I understand.
You could say yes, he's responsible, but he didn't pull the trigger.
Sure.
In my view, that snick is probably what killed her.
Wow.
Maybe not, but I only put the sound in there because when I saw the picture, and it was not my intention that he killed her, but when I saw the picture and you see the way that Gil drew her, with her body sort of flipping backwards and her head sort of swinging backwards, you get the full impression that at least Gil thought, that there was a kind of a whiplash thing going on there.
Absolutely.
So putting the sound effect in seemed like the natural thing to do.
Did you ever talk?
I think it was.
Go ahead.
No, I never spoke to Gil about it.
Oh, okay. And what were you going to say? You thought what?
Well, I think that on some level there was this kind of unconscious collaboration between the two of us. Unspoken, undiscussed, here, do with this what you will, from Gil, and me going, okay. the two of us sort of like going, yeah, I think that's what happened. But I don't think either one of us really thought past that, and I'm always been surprised by the fact that Roy let it go through as the editor. He saw it. I don't think he thought twice about it.
And then did Stan have any reaction after it came out and was like, hey, what did you do? Wait a minute.
Well, I think Stan didn't realize, first of all, for Stan it was just another story.
Okay.
And he had done this before. He had killed off characters before. But he'd always done it in the traditional Marvel way,
heroic death.
The heroic death, the guy throwing himself in front of the bullet, a la, Johnny Storm's dad, Johnny and Sue's dad, or, Gwen Stacy's father, saving the little kid.
Yes.
I mean, all of that stuff. And I, as a member of a more cynical generation, came along and did exactly the same story, but in a kind of a very dark, defeated sort of way. And in the same, the natural descendant of this story is the Dark Knight, the Dark Knight film, in which, Batman rushes to go rescue the woman that he loves and goes into the goes to the wrong place. That's not something that would ever have been done in the comics, and probably still to this day would never be done in the comics, where Batman fails like that. Now, he, you could say, wasn't culpable for the failure because he didn't, he thought he was going to rescue her. But, you could also say that he didn't think it through, that he didn't realize that if the Joker was implying that she was at place X, that she was probably then at place Y, because that would be the joke, right?
Absolutely.
you could say that he was culpable in that sense.
And what about the Sam Raimi film, the first film? I mean, what goes through your mind as someone who wrote that story and see it play out on the screen, but of course see it play out where the hero is successful and stuff. What were your thoughts as you were watching?
Well, I understood totally. I mean, I wouldn't have done that story as the first Spider-Man story. I mean, what a bummer that would have been. Bad enough.
Oh, definitely.
He's semi-responsible for his uncle's death. To then have him, be directly responsible or implicated in the death of his girlfriend. That would have been, kill us now.
Oh, no, I agree with that.
And also, it's a different media,
Sure.
Superhero movies are not for, with the exception of movies like Dark Knight and Watchmen, are not for adults.
Sure.
Or haven't been for adults. A story that's supposed to appeal to 13-year-olds. This is why it was so bizarre that we did this story in the comics. As we did. At that time, we were still thinking of our audience as 13-year-olds.
Well, and I think I was 9 at the time. Was it 73? What year was this that you did this? Or 71?
Yeah,
okay, 73. 73. Yeah, I mean, I was 9. And I mean, and as a 9-year-old, it didn't scar me, but if anything, it blew my mind. And what do you think of the whole... I mean, unfortunately, I'm a living example of this as someone in my 40s still reading comics. I can say that you're in the boat with me because...
Sure.
but yeah, what do you think of the medium kind of growing up with its readers and now trying to entertain this adult audience as well?
Well, I think it's fine. I think that it's another mythology that is useful for telling stories with. I was thinking about the fact that, the baby boomer generation we will never let go, of our childhood toys. I mean, look at it. We're still listening to the same music that we were listening to, and we've had such an impact on the world that there has been really no progression outside of, you know, if you take rap music as a progression, but there's been no progression in rock since 1967.
You're right.
You know, it's the same, you know, you could, it's a little faster tempo, you know, but that's basically it. You know, a Coldplay song could play in 1967, and it would be the same, you know, the audience would say, oh, yeah, that's good, you know.
Sure.
And that's not, and I'm fine with that, you know, but I'm stunned by it at the same time, because that's 40 years later. Go back 40 years before 1967, and you're talking about an entirely different kind of music.
Absolutely.
You know, 1927, you're talking about something that would be incomprehensible in 67. How is it that the music of 2009 could be listened to by somebody in 1967 and be recognizable? It's a real statement about how this generation, you know, the baby boomer generation, dominates. And one of the things we're dominating with is our interest in comics. You know, the comics that we read when we were kids, we are now making into movies.
Yeah.
You know, it's, I mean, Sam Raimi is not quite a, I don't know if he's a boomer or not, but he read my stuff when he was a kid. That's the stuff that was his touchstone.
Absolutely.
And so that's what he's interested in telling. That's the kind of stories he's interested in telling.
Wow. What'd you think of Watchmen, the film?
I think I loved it, to be honest. To me, Watchmen is to superhero movies what The Wild Bunch was to Westerns.
I like that. I could buy it, absolutely.
You know, you can go on and continue to make Westerns after The Wild Bunch, but really the mythology is dead. I mean, you have to basically ignore the movie in order to go on and make other movies. And that's what happened with The Wild Bunch. You know, the Wild Bunch summed up an entire mythological structure and tied it up in a nice neat knot and put a stake through it. And in my mind, that's sort of what Watchmen has done. I was heartbroken by that film. I mean, I loved the comic book, but I tell you that the comic book didn't leave me feeling as sad as the movie did.
That's really interesting.
Yeah, you know, I mean, when Rorschach dies at the end of that film, you know, I was heartbroken. You know, I mean, and who would have thought? You know, here you have this character who's an unrelenting madman, and by the end of the movie, you're on his side.
Yeah.
That's an accomplishment, and it's the same thing that happens in Wild Bunch. You know, where you see these guys who are reprehensible human beings. You know, I mean, the first thing that I think William Holden says, you know, is if they move, kill them. You know, and he's talking about these people. You know, they're just ordinary people, and then they go out in the middle of the street and they're just killing everybody around them.
Oh yeah,
and by the end of the movie, when those guys go walking down, you know, into their to their deaths, you know, you're feeling like, oh my God, you know, I feel sad for these folks. You know, there's something lost here, and I think that's what was accomplished with Watchmen. I think the fact that the movie wasn't a hit is not surprising to me. I don't know why on God's earth anyone would have financed that film. Seriously,
I understand what you're saying. Absolutely,
I'm very glad they did, but they must have been drinking something, you know, or smoking something to think that there was going to be an audience for it. Any more than there would have been an audience for Wild Bunch. I mean, it's surprising that Wild Bunch did find an audience. But if you look at the original critical reaction to Wild Bunch, it was just mercilessly hammered by everybody except, I think, Pauline Kael.
Well, maybe Watchmen too. Then will because it seems like the fanboy, the overwhelming negative response to it seemed was it was too on the nose, and that to me always strikes me as odd in terms of that's a negative thing. It's like, well, you know, and also that I think Zack Snyder played to that same baby boomer memory of I know a big complaint was that the songs were too on, like Sounds of Silence during the funeral, or even Flight of the Valkyries during the Vietnam scenes and stuff. You know, exactly, and that's the kind of reaction I had. I laughed, too, and in appreciation of that, in terms of course these things fit. Of course you're going to use these songs at those moments. So, yeah, maybe time will maybe time will be kinder to it from a fan standpoint than, like you say, what the critics initially thought of it.
Yeah, I do think that it's going to, I think it's going to be a rediscovered movie. I mean, maybe when the director's cut comes out on DVD, you know, people will have a better sense of what it was that he accomplished. But it's in my mind, I mean, I thought it was the best movie of the year, and I still do, you know, I mean, and I like a lot of the movies that have come out this year, so I'm not, you know, saying there's a bunch of stinkers out there, but it's a movie that I've seen, I saw it three times, and I've only seen Dark Knight once, and the reason that, I like Dark Knight quite a bit.
Me too.
But I didn't want to go back and re-experience Dark Knight. Although I fully intend to at some point. But with Watchmen, I wanted to go back and re-immerse myself in that world and re-engage with those characters. And those characters, I think, were far more empathetic than they were in the comic. And that's without changing anything about them. You know, I don't think that that Schneider did anything different with the characters than Alan Moore had done. Just that he made them, I think, more empathetic just by the fact that we could see the pain that they were experiencing, you know, physically. I mean, Moore constantly talks about how you can't do his comic books as films because of the difference in the medium, you know, the media.
Mm-hmm.
That comics, you know, you can break a scene down and see fractions of a moment. You know, in slivers of time. And that's absolutely true. But there's also, you know, an upside to that, which is that when you see the film version of something, if it's done well, as I think that Watchmen was done, you get to see things that you couldn't see in the comic book. You know, you get to see the pain in the character's eyes in a way that you couldn't see in a comic book that's frozen in time. And I think, you know, Moore is both correct and wrong, you know, and that's fine too, you know, because he's an icon, you know, and somebody I admire tremendously, but he's not a filmmaker, nor should he be, and, you know, he doesn't see what the language of films brings to things that is not available to him as a comic book writer.
You've been patient with me, and I know I'm keeping you from your dinner, so I just want to ask you in closing, with all that in mind, would you want to write a comic book script and try and do a film? I know you did Fire and Ice, and I hope we have a future conversation where we can talk about that and Firestorm and some of the things that we haven't talked about. That's the great thing about your career, Jerry. I mean, there are so many things to cover. But you know, to leave it on this...
And I'm a talker, too. So.
No, and that's... No, and I honestly, man, I really appreciate it. I know my listeners will, too, because... you know, really, it's a pleasure to be able to talk to you, and I know a lot of people want to know what you think and you know, appreciate your time in the business and your insight in what you see. So would you want to do that? Would you want to write a comic book film script?
Actually, I don't really want to work in film and television again, so it's
okay.
Not even that I wouldn't want to write a comic book, although I find myself going, oh, that'd make a cool scene. But the compromises of working in film are such that... anything that I would do there wouldn't really be mine anyway.
Okay.
You know, by the time it's done, that's a younger guy's medium too. You know, I mean, that's for people who have got the patience and the stamina and the energy and the passion to put up with the crap, you know, that you have to put up with.
John Shulman told me the same thing. The writer, I don't know if you worked with him or not on Hercules, but
which
John Shulman?
Oh, yeah, I think I've met him.
Okay. Well, I know he had told me the same thing, that, yeah, when he was done with television, he was kind of done.
It's a quote from somebody, you know, that I don't remember the context of it, but just, you know, I'm too old and too rich. I'm not rich, but, you know, I'm too old, certainly, you know, and I don't need to do it the way that I needed to do it back then. And it's that need that gets you through the pain of the compromises, you know, because you're constantly saying to yourself, this is going to be better, you know, the next iteration of this will be better. You know, once I get past this, then it'll be fine. You know, and you're still so caught up and passionate that you believe that that's going to happen. Well, it isn't. You know, and that's what experience and time brings you to, is that you start saying, well, you know, if I haven't done it by this point, I'm probably not going to. That's not to say it can't be done. You know, I think, like, for example, I worked with Bob and Alex, Alex Kurtzman and Bob Orsi on Hercules also. And those guys are enormously talented and passionate, and they're getting to make the movies that they wanted to make.
They wrote Star Trek, correct?
Yeah, Star Trek.
Yeah.
Transformers. You know, The Island. You know, they're the guys of summer. You know, the boys of summer.
Absolutely.
And they know how to do it, and they've got the passion and the fire to make it happen. And I can't wait to see what they do next.
There you go.
They've got it.
Well, I will ask then if we could maybe a few months from now, maybe as Animal Man is wrapping up, if we could check in again.
Sure.
That would be wonderful. And I like I said, there's so much that we haven't talked about. I know there are Firestorm fans that are tearing their hair out that we didn't have a chance to talk about Ronnie Raymond.
Well, you know, as I say, I'm a talker, so anytime.
What a pleasure to have a chance to talk with Jerry Conway. I've been following that guy since I was a kid, and it's great to see that he's still writing great stories. The Last Days of Animal Man, issue 2, came out last Wednesday. It's on the stands from DC Comics, a 6-issue miniseries. And look for some of Jerry's classic runs from Marvel and DC, also collected by the respective publishers. And we'll be talking to Jerry in a few months and catch up more, because, as I said, so much of his career yet to go through, and would love the opportunity to talk more with Jerry Conway. This episode of Word Balloon is brought to you by tomorrow's publication, The Comic Book Podcast Companion. Comic book podcasts have taken the internet by storm, and Tomorrow's is offering you the chance to get behind the scenes of 10 of today's top comic book podcasts. You'll be hearing interviews with the cast of Around Comics, Quiet Panelologists at Work, The Comic Book Queers, iFanboy, The Crankcast, Collected Comics Library, Tomorrow's Own TuneIn Podcast, The Pipeline Podcast, Comic Geek Speak, and me, John Sutters from Word Balloon. How about that? It's a great book. It also features interviews with Gene Colan, Tim Seeley, and Matt Fraction, and art by those three guys as well, including Mike Norton art as well. You'll find all that in there, and a great cover from Mike Manley. It retails for $15.95. If you order it from their website, tomorrows.com, you can get it for $13.56 and save 15% off the cover price. There's a digital edition of the book also available for $9.95. Just go to their website, tomorrows.com, tomorrows.com. The Comic Book Podcast Companion, written by Eric Houston from Tomorrow's Publishing. That'll do it for this edition of Word Balloon. Thanks for listening. John Suntress reminding you that Word Balloon is all over the internet. Come to our website, wordballoon.com. We've got an archive of well over 200 interviews with comic creators like Jerry Conway. But also, you can find us at iTunes if you search under Word Balloon. If you're at iTunes, feel free to leave us a review and a rating. That would be terrific. And if you have any questions or comments about the show, come to the Word Balloon Forum, which is at wordballoon.com and also available at jinxworld.com. Or you can email me, john@wordballoon.com. Until next time, Word Balloon is a copyright feature of Shaky Productions, copyright 2009.